Welcome to the Television Academy of Arts and Sciences. Did you have any question about the Academy and its mission?
No.
Good, because we don't really do anything except give out the Emmys. Why are you here?
I'm here to pick up my Emmy.
Your Emmy for what?
My Emmy for Breaking Bad.
Well, that's just wonderful. I don't recognize you from the cast. Are you involved in some technical aspect of the show?
You could say that, yeah.
What area?
Watching.
Watching. I'm not familiar with that.
That's because the Emmys have been negligent about honoring those of us who make the industry what it is. Do you know the name of the first person who ever watched TV?
I'm afraid not.
My point exactly. There should be a special award named after that person. There should be awards for best live tweeter, best binge watcher, and for technical accomplishment with a DVR. Last year you gave an Emmy to Behind the Candelabra.
Yeah, we're really sorry about that.
And nothing to the person who kept watching Homeland, no matter how annoying it got.
So your award would be for watching Breaking Bad?
Yeah, I was always on time, and I paid really close attention, and I knew Hank was going to...
Whoa. I haven't watched it yet.
But you work for the Academy.
We're only open around the awards show, and then we take 10 months off. I'm more a reader, really. Look, take this Emmy.
Really?
Somebody from Modern Family left it backstage last year, and I never got around to tracking the person down. They win so many. It's kind of obscene, really.
Well, thank you. I'd also like to thank my family and my third grade teacher, Pat Smith.
Do that outside, please.
Fine. Today on the show, some Emmy analysis, how Twitter shaped the Ferguson story, and an independent candidate for governor stares into the abyss. And now he still has B. Arthur's swag bag from 1988, Colin McEnroe.
It's a long story. She left it in my hotel room in Beverly Hills. And I don't know. I don't believe in really talking about these things. All right. Yes, we are going to talk about the Emmys later in the show. They are tonight. They've been moved to Monday nights. And there's all kinds of other pre-Emmy analysis to do. So we'll do that toward the end of the show today. This is The Scramble. We tend to cover a lot of ground on this show. Jonathan Pelta will join us also in the second segment. As you know, he was a petitioning candidate for governor. And he is sort of right now staring into the abyss of not having enough signatures. So we'll talk about sort of where that effort is, but also talk about the process itself, which is, I think most of us would agree, more cumbersome than it needs to be and more complicated. We're going to start, though, with talking about the media itself. We're going to talk to Mark Coddington. He writes weekly for the Nieman Journalism Lab. He's a PhD student in digital journalism and media sociology at the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. But his weekly column in Nieman Journalism Lab is a must read if you're following this industry and this art. So thank you very much for joining us today, Mark Coddington.
Thank you, Colin. Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk a little bit about the role that social media played in the coverage of Ferguson. And you can kind of divide that into at least two parts and maybe more, but we can sort of start with the placing of Ferguson on the agenda of people's attention. And one argument that's been made, and you've covered it as well, is that Twitter at least played a pretty significant role in just focusing people in on a story that might have floated for a while anyway in a vaster sea of other news stories.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we found, and actually Pew had some data. You know, they analyzed this pretty systematically, and they did find that Twitter was the first medium or the first platform to really pick up Ferguson as a story. And after that, cable news picked it up pretty quickly after that, and then they really kind of tracked together. But this was a story that started on Twitter in terms of reaching people's attention, and Twitter really has driven it kind of the entire way through the news cycle. So that's something that's not necessarily new to this story, something we've been seeing with a lot of different stories over the past, you know, 5 years or so. But we're beginning to see a pattern of certain types of stories that really are kind of work well, are built for Twitter, or that Twitter is built for. And this turned out to be one of them.
So in some ways, this is a little bit of a surprise if you think about the just overall bite that Twitter has of the media market. I mean, Pew also says, I think the last numbers I saw from Pew were that 19% of all adult online users use Twitter at all. So I guess what's significant is not that number, but the percentage of people making decisions about the rest of the media who are somehow or other taking cues from Twitter.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Twitter is, we shouldn't really think of it as being, you know, representative of the American public or the internet-using public or even the social media-using public in any sort of way. But one really important role that it's grown to have in kind of developing the media agenda is it's where people from the media are. And it's become an incredibly effective way to get the media's attention about underreported or less visible sort of issues, because that's where journalists are obsessed with Twitter, and that's where journalists are, that's where their editors are, that's where their managers are, that's where the people who make decisions about what goes on your TV and what goes in your newspaper, they're scouring Twitter all the time. So even if there's not a huge portion of the American public there, there's a really a disproportionate number of journalists and members of the media there. So if there can be kind of a groundswell of opinion and a groundswell of sentiment on Twitter about a breaking event, that can usually be kind of the megaphone that's used to get the media's attention, whereas previously there wasn't as natural of a megaphone for such kind of grassroots causes or social movements.
So, and this also pointed up a real difference between Twitter and Facebook. If you primarily used Facebook as your social medium and didn't use Twitter, you would be a little bit late to the Ferguson party, right? It wasn't really popping up on people's news feeds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most people on Facebook, what you were seeing the past 2 weeks was not the situation in Ferguson, but mostly people dumping buckets of ice water on their heads. And that was something that I noticed early on when the confrontation between police and protesters first started up. This had been about a week and a half ago in Ferguson. I was constantly following Twitter like a lot of different people were and looking at live streams and cable news. And I flipped over to Facebook because I thought, I bet I have some friends who have some opinions on this. I wonder what they have to say. And it was just nothing. It was silent, and it was really eerie to see the difference between the two. And that was something that caught a lot of other people's attention. Obviously, everybody's Facebook feeds look different, but there were a lot of different people who were noticing around the same time, there's nobody's talking about this on Facebook. And to the degree that, you know, there are a lot of people who use both platforms, it was kind of strange to see those two platforms being used in completely different ways. So that led to kind of a scramble over the past week to kind of figure out and try to understand why we would be seeing such huge differences between these two big social media platforms, especially on this story.
And one piece I know you linked to is, I may be saying her name wrong, although I'm fascinated by her work. I read it all the time. Zeynep Tufekci, writing in Medium, on Medium.com, writing about this very phenomenon. So some of it is probably the culture of Facebook, and we can swing back to that in a second. But some of it is not how people use Facebook, but how Facebook works, right? They have a filtering algorithm that kind of determines what's going to pop up high on your newsfeed.
Right, absolutely. That's the big one that kind of gets people's attention because it is so different than Twitter. I mean, Twitter, in theory and very, very often in practice, you get to choose exactly what goes into your feed. If somebody tweets something and you're following them, it will come into your feed exactly in the order that it was published. And in Facebook, that all goes through this mysterious black box that determines what you're going to see and when you're going to see it. And as a somebody who's posting on Facebook, most of the people who are friends with you or who are fans of you are not going to see what you post, and you have relatively little say over who's going to end up seeing that. And the same goes when you're consuming something. You have to kind of consume your Facebook news feed, understanding that this is a very kind of mysteriously hand-picked set of stories that Facebook has been very coy about how it does so, how it picks these stories and what goes into its algorithm, because they don't want people to game it. So that's a big part of it, is the fact that, you know, there's this algorithm that we don't really understand, but we do know some things where we can kind of guess at or understand some of the things, the principles that Facebook has in putting together its algorithm. And one thing that we see with Twitter is that for them, newness and freshness is incredibly important. It's whatever is the most recent thing that people have posted that goes to the top of your feed. With Facebook, they've clearly decided that being up to the minute is not as important. That's not the primary kind of determinant of relevance to you as a user. And in their calculation, because you can see this anytime you go 3, 4, 5 days away from Facebook and come back, you're not going to get the newest post. You're going to get 3-day-old Facebook posts. And so that means that when you have an event that's unfolding so rapidly, like Ferguson, Facebook is just not going to be that useful for it, because information that's 6 hours old may be considered pretty relevant by Facebook's algorithm, but in Twitter time, in an event like Ferguson, that's pretty, you know, useless to you, or certainly has quite a bit less value. So some of it is the algorithm itself, and some of it is just this lack of necessarily emphasis on time as really the structuring aspect for Facebook.
I would just observe in passing that this is all stuff that the average social media user doesn't think about at all.
No.
It's, you know, I always compare it to the difference between buying a car and driving over a bridge. If you're buying a car, you want to know as much as you can about how the car works, what it's likely to break down from, what its safety record is, stuff like that. With a bridge, you don't really do a whole lot of investigating. People treat all the platforms they use online like bridges, but they're kind of using cars, really. It's worth it to know how the thing works and how it doesn't work, but nobody ever really investigates that.
Right, right. And I think Facebook is not necessarily like hidden, you know, they don't necessarily hide the fact that they use an algorithm and that you're not actually really seeing what all the people that you're friends with or fans of are posting, but they're not very out front with it. And I think their goal is for you to just kind of naturalize it and see it as, oh, well, this is what's going on today. Well, this is what Facebook has, you know, decided what might be most interesting to you in what's going on. So I think you're absolutely right that a lot of people just treat them all as the same, and I see the same way content comes to me on Twitter is probably the same way it comes to me on Facebook, when in reality those are two very differently structured platforms with different philosophies about what people want to read and how they want to see it.
We're talking to Mark Coddington right now. You have to read his weekly summation of journalism news on Nieman Journalism Lab's site. So we're going to talk at more length about the role that Twitter plays in shaping news perceptions and in calling our attention to things that we wouldn't otherwise know about. But so I don't forget anyway, it's worth noting another thing, which is that, you know, as we talk about the events in Ferguson, we're going to talk about a lot of really fairly outrageous stuff and stuff that really requires some kind of long-term thinking, some long-term study, maybe even some long-term outrage about what happened. But I wonder if the concern I have about Twitter is exactly what you said, which is it favors the latest thing. It favors the newest thing. It favors what's quote-unquote trending. And so you wonder whether, even though Twitter was a great model for looking at Ferguson over 6, 7, 8, 9 days, whether it's also a great model for forgetting about Ferguson 3 months from now.
That's absolutely right. And I think it's why thinking about it now, as the story has begun to subside, although it's, you know, it's dominated at least my Twitter feed this morning with Michael Brown's funeral, it's good to think about, okay, now that I'm kind of done being inundated with updates, what don't I understand yet? And what's missing from my understanding of how things work? And as I find in my own media diet, and I think a lot of people find in their own media diets if they examine it, you end up with really kind of distorted understandings of what's going on. And I think especially when you're relying on Twitter as a source of information for these really quickly unfolding events, you end up with a disproportionately strong understanding of kind of the blow-by-blow of what happened when and which journalists were arrested at this point and which police captain used tear gas on which people. But you end up with a relatively weak understanding of some of the bigger picture social causes that might be at work and kind of the geographical context of where is Ferguson and what type of neighborhood is it and the historical context, things like that. And those are things that, you know, certain other forms of journalism, like, you know, historically magazine journalism and other things like that, and to an extent very good newspaper journalism have been good at. And it takes some work to go seek that kind of thing out online to really fill out our understanding. And I think you're absolutely right that it's very easy to forget about a story like Ferguson a week later when the media has left, the national media, and, you know, unless you're in St. Louis, you don't have any sort of media sources that are attuned to this all the time, and your Twitter feed has moved on to whatever's the next, you know, kind of controversy of the day or of the week. And so I think it takes some consciousness in how you consume media to kind of some self-examination to examine what else am I missing here, and where might I, you know, be able to find it? Because it's easy to get kind of sucked into the source that we find most interesting and that is most useful for us in a certain situation, only to realize that that it's left us with a kind of a warped understanding of an event or an issue.
We're talking to Mark Coddington right now. He writes for Nieman Journalism Lab. So yeah, and I think there are also some real differences. I mean, we don't need to go into it at length, but there's really differences also. I mean, we're effectively talking about software right now or digital platforms. There's differences in hardware, too. I noticed this because I was out of town during a lot of Ferguson. I was in somebody else's apartment. I had an iPad with me. I didn't have a laptop. With an iPad, you are going to do that thing, right? You're going to do that thing where you're maybe scrolling around on Twitter and tapping on links and stuff like that. Whereas I think, particularly if you have any kind of journalistic background, if you've got a laptop or netbook or something like that, you're probably going to build your own mosaic of information a little bit more proactively and a little bit more aggressively. But people using tablets and phones, they probably depend a lot more on the digital platform they're using.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, you know, this is part of the reason I generally prefer to use my laptop is because I can kind of act as a news-consuming sort of power user. And a lot of that's different because that's part of my job. But I can really kind of look and open a lot of different new tabs and examine, you know, oh, this one looks good. I want to save this and read it, you know, and really give it my full attention. Oh, you know, this I can just scan a headline and get rid of it. Whereas on a phone, you just end up your kind of media consumption process just gets really kind of shrunk and really attenuated. And so it ends up being just necessarily, it ends up being bits and bytes. And so it's really difficult if your main way of accessing news is through the phone. There are different ways that you can kind of find, you know, pieces that you can really devote a long period of time and your attention to deeper news and analysis. But it just ends up tending to lend itself towards quick, superficial, and really recent kind of based news consumption, which that's the way, that's the device that most of us are using to consume news, and that's the way we're doing it.
So one of the things that Twitter did well, I think, was introduce new kinds of information from unforeseeable sources. And probably the most frequently cited of this was the so-called live stream platform that was coming from Argus Radio and then other people. I mean, I'm barely beginning to understand this today, but there was another piece on NPR about it. But there's a company called Livestream. Argus Radio was using their technology. So were other people. And I saw that in real time being circulated on Twitter. Like, hey, you're not getting the kind of news that you want from whatever legacy news source they might want to mention. Try this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was using that too. And it really is fascinating. I think it's a really interesting source of news and an interesting exercise. One, just to kind of follow a news story that way, just for the news value, and two, to be able to see and understand the degree to which the TV news that you get of events like that is really, really filtered, and filtered in really interesting ways. And so to compare, you know, that same Argus live stream, you know, would watch it or have it open as I was, you know, reading about what was going on Twitter. And then periodically, if you went to CNN or Fox News or something like that, you might get them to break in for, you know, a one-minute stand-up. And you get to see how narrow the snapshot is when the media has to be processed through so many different filters, as opposed to just being able to see this live stream that is one person's, it's not totally unfiltered because they're still choosing to show you certain things on camera, but one person's raw experience. And that's a really, I think it can be a powerful way to experience a news story, and a really kind of interestingly different way to consume a news story. I think it's tough to make sense of a lot of times. And so there's still a very valuable role for consuming stuff that has been run through filters and editors and gatekeepers to help us understand the totality of what's going on beyond what one person is seeing through their, you know, video camera.
I think one of the things that digital journalism did well this time and typically does do pretty well is sort of crowdsource information. And it can come a lot of different ways. Zeynep Tufekci, in that same article we're talking about, talked about how on Twitter, after a while, people in Cairo, people in Ukraine were chiming in with advice about how to get through a tear gas attack if tear gas is fired at you. But also with, you know, more professional journalism, at one point, for example, they were using one of those sound wave cannons on people, and immediately or very quickly, Gizmodo or TechCrunch, it was Gizmodo, I guess, one of the tech sites, had kind of a report, well, what is that thing? Is it dangerous? Could it actually damage your hearing permanently? And I'm not sure a legacy news source that didn't have quite as many specialists in an area like that could have done something as quick and reliable as that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the great kind of advantages and potentials of crowdsourcing is the ability to tap into such a wide range of expertise. That's kind of one of the mantras of this movement going back at least a decade is that my readers or my audience knows more than I do. And I think journalists are in the habit of being able to put, you know, kind of position themselves as experts. And if I'm at least not an expert on this, I will spend, you know, an hour talking to somebody who actually is, and then I'll tell you what you need to know. And I think what's cool about these sort of processes that are more bottom up and a lot more networked and not really bound by, you know, specific institutions is that you're able to tap into a much wider range of expertise than can be contained in one, you know, journalism or newspaper newsroom or something like that. And there's a real potential to be able to tap into that very quickly and in real time, these types of expertise, like you said, technological, scientific, sociological, political. There are so many experts out there who have a lot of knowledge, but just don't have the kind of natural built-in platform that the traditional media has always had. And it can be a great way of giving people the kind of appropriate microphone at the right time, and they can react to that a lot more quickly than a more institutional media source might.
All right, let's finish here with one of the downsides of all this, which is that Twitter creates a pace for news reporting, and then other kinds of legacy media feel an obligation to match that pace. So you've got these reporters here who are, and this has been talked about a lot, but, you know, if you ever, it was bad enough before there was Twitter. If you ever watched, you know, a national crew of reporters, I mean, either the bunch of people on the plane or on the bus for a presidential campaign or almost any other swarm of reporters arriving in a national event, I mean, the urge and the immediate obligation to file something right now vastly exceeded what they actually knew at any given moment, and it started to eat into their time to find out what was actually happening. Well, it's a million times worse now, right? If you're tweeting all the time, if you're having to completely update your information, you don't have as much time to analyze really what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you talk to journalists, whether they're covering events like this or any kind of event that has some sort of breaking news value, they will, you know, they'll tell you that that is a tension that they struggle with constantly. The need to tell people what's going on right now, which is inevitably going to kind of structure your story into little, you know, small, immediately focused, narrowly focused chunks and slices, versus the idea that I've got to get, you know, I've got to get some breathing room on this situation and get some idea of the context. And a lot of journalism for so long has been trying to find out context incredibly quickly, and trying to get a sense and give people a sense, you know, getting up to speed on big picture, gigantic social issues, you know, and situations that are really complicated within, you know, a matter of hours. And that those two goals are really at odds. And I think it makes it pretty difficult for individual reporters to do. I think one thing that can help is if you're thinking as a news organization, not so much on the reporter level, but more generally on sort of a team level. And I think you've seen some of the bigger news organizations that have the staff to do this have done it very effectively, where they have people on the ground who are the people giving the updates every 5 minutes, what's going on Twitter. And you saw this in the Ferguson story. And then you have other people who are pretty much quiet on social media while they're working back channels and finding sources and doing research. And then they produce the next day, you know, some big, you know, piece that really helps explain and untangle some of the deeper questions behind. So I think there is a place for both. And I think it can even be done by the same journalists if they're extremely skilled. But it's certainly more difficult. That is no doubt. As you've said, it's something that didn't start with Twitter. It's been going on even since well before television. But it's become, if you talk to journalists, it's become a much more pressing concern for them, balancing the now and the deep big picture.
Mark Coddington, thanks so much for joining us today. Mark's work is seen weekly at the Nieman Journalism Lab. He also has markcoddington.com, his own site. We're going to take a break. We'll come back with Jonathan Pelto after this.
A billion people died on the news tonight, but not so many cried at the devil's sight. Well, Mama said, it's just make-believe. You can't believe everything you see, so baby, close your eyes to the lullaby.
Welcome back to The Scramble, and we are scrambling today, but we're scrambling effectively. By the way, as we talk to Jonathan Pelto here, if you have your own questions, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Well, Jonathan Pelto, for the last, month plus, there's been a lot of excitement around your potential candidacy for governor. You'd be running effectively as an independent, although with the Education and Democracy Party. The key was, of course, getting 7,500 validated signatures to to get yourself on the ballot. What we've been reading over the weekend is that this effort is starting to look a little cloudy at best, and maybe worse than that. What can you tell us right now?
Yeah, you had said organized scramble. So the process has really been an eye-opener and would should be filed under disorganized scramble. It really boils down to the fact that at this point they're still counting. They'll count through probably Wednesday or Thursday, and anything is possible. But for the first time, I've become more pessimistic that we've reached the magic number of 7,500. The legal, structural, and political barriers were, quite frankly, greater than I had expected. I take full responsibility for not collecting enough, for having a campaign that didn't collect enough signatures. But we've really learned a lot about how dysfunctional, how primitive the process is, and how the quote-unquote incumbency party, whether it's Democrat, Republican, the establishment, the insiders, have set up basically a system that is almost impossible to qualify for the ballot. That said, hats off to Joe Visconti, who did do a remarkable job. He collected 10,600 signatures. He got the 7,500 he needed, in part because he had a table sitting outside of Hoffman's gun shop where he was able to collect signatures from everybody who walked in and out buying guns and ammunition. And if my issue was guns instead of education, we might have had a different outcome. And then he had a very good strategy of going to those towns that were having budget referendums where there were lots of voters. We went with a more both central and decentralized effort, and I thought it was enough. I still think we probably got about 8,000 or 9,000 signatures. But what we weren't prepared for was the significant number that would be rejected, including many. We've identified well over 100, closing in on 200, who were rejected inappropriately or even illegally. The problem is that even with those names, we may not be close enough to make a lawsuit worthwhile.
So just to sort of familiarize people with this a little bit, I mean, probably the toughest thing about this, correct me if I'm wrong, but probably the toughest thing about this is that you can't collect all of your signatures in one place onto one petition and turn it into the state. All of the petitions have to be for the town in which the person resides. So if you're standing out in front of Hoffman's Guns and people come from Barkhamsted and people come from Berlin and people come from Coventry to buy their guns, you have to have them sign onto a petition for that town and then turn that petition in Coventry, in Berlin, in Barkhamsted.
That's right. So from the very beginning, it's an uphill climb. So in essence, when you go to a public event, you have to have up to 169 sheets of paper because people have to sign on the sheet that goes to that person's town clerk. And the smallest mistake in looking through our petitions, we saw dozens of examples despite trying hard to train our people to say, are you a registered voter? What town are you a registered voter in? I'll give you an example. So one of our people put WH at the top of the sheet. I think they meant West Hartford. At some point during the day, they got confused and thought it was Wethersfield. Mm-hmm. And so out of the 30 names on the sheet, there were about 10 from West Hartford where the petition got sent and about 20 that got rejected because they were voters, but they were voters in Wethersfield and the sheet got sent to West Hartford. And in this day and age, you'd think that you'd be able – there is a centralized voter file. You'd think the Secretary of State could check that or you could scan it and send it to two different towns. But the law is so old and so primitive that it says if you sign on the wrong town, you're signature doesn't count. And then we found
– even if you put all of your information down accurately.
That's right.
Yeah, your address or whatever. It's all
– that's
doesn't
right.
make any difference.
And the for example, you sign it. You put your name. There's a space for birth date, which is not optional in primaries but is optional in general elections. And then your address. So we found a whole lot of people being rejected because their birth date field was blank, even though we had been told it was optional. The Secretary of State's office attorney said those names should not have been rejected. There's no reason to reject those. Another category was there are people who are on the active voter list and the inactive voter list. You get put on the inactive voter list if you don't vote for a couple of cycles. The law is very clear. You need to be moved back to the active list. But in many towns, the town clerks, it turned out that the registrars seemed knowledgeable about the law, but town clerks not as much. And so they were rejecting names where there was no birth date, even though it wasn't necessary. They were rejecting names the person was on the inactive voter list when they should have been allowed to. And the answer was, when I said, you know, what do we do? How do we fix these? They said there's really no way to do it because you'd have to take this petition back to the town clerk and ask them to reconsider. But because you can't touch this petition and you've already missed the window to put in the petition, it's a sort of a Kafkaesque or Monty Python scene where they said, yes, what's happened is against the law, but there's nothing that you can do except to sue us after the fact.
So, and this is sort of an interesting point, and I think it is a real difference between how we handle the registration of voters, which is our goal is to have as many people register to vote as possible and have as many people be able to vote as possible. And I mean, there are some people who will describe their experiences at Connecticut polling places a little bit differently, but by and large, I think that's the overall goal. Let's get as many people into this process as we possibly can. This process that you're describing here seems to exist to disqualify people. It doesn't exist to include people in the process of signing petitions to get somebody onto a ballot. It exists to disqualify signatures. There isn't a part of this process that has to do, as you're saying, with correcting any mistake that might be made by a town clerk. Or there isn't, even though it's a two-tier process, there's a town process, there's a Secretary of State process, there's no part of that process that fixes the mistakes.
That's right. One would think that it's almost perfectly designed to make it almost impossible to get on the ballot. And it's one of the great ironies, particularly I think I say this as a lifelong Democrat, that, you know, we're for more voter registration, we're mail-in registration, same-day registration, early voting, against any of the quote-unquote Republican efforts to suppress voting. And then you say, hey, by the way, I'd like to run. And the first thing they say is, A, you're a spoiler, and B, you have to go through a process that is extremely difficult. And finally, you know, and again, we just didn't get enough signatures, and the Secretary of State's office staff is very open about it. They say, look, that's why we tell you to get more than enough signatures, because lots of legal signatures get rejected, even though that's illegal. Mm. But we also, you know, the fact that the pushback from the political establishment was a barrier that I expected, but not quite as much as happened. I mean, to be told that, you know, despite having been endorsed in each of my legislative elections by the AFL-CIO and finishing up my career back as a legislator with one of the highest labor ratings, the fact that the AFL-CIO wouldn't allow me to come and speak to their convention, that the American Federation of Teachers wouldn't allow me to fill out a questionnaire or have an interview or even speak to their executive committee, the CEA said that I couldn't stand outside of their summer leadership conference to collect signatures because it would be perceived as an unfair advantage. Those are not the reasons I'm falling short, but it is an interesting commentary about how the quote-unquote establishment is able to ensure that there are as few candidates as possible on the ballot.
So, Jonathan Belto, I mean, it sounds like you're somewhat resigned, although maybe holding one tiny little birthday candle of hope up in the darkness, but somewhat resigned to the fact that this is probably not going to work out for you. You're probably not going to get on the ballot. What's your role the rest of the way from August to November? What do you do?
Well, still sort of grappling with that. I think that the issues that I was raising are important issues, that I want to look for ways to continue to raise those issues. The highlight of this whole experience, other than obviously lots and lots of people coming forward to support my candidacy, although not enough who signed petitions, was that I was really interested that the media was so open to third-party candidates, far more than the establishment. There was a lot of media coverage, and that makes me give some hope to the longer-term chance of reforming the system, but also to the possibility that maybe we can come up with ways to continue to force these issues into the public domain. Even though my guess is that the two major party candidates really don't want that to happen. The thing that I feel worst about is that I was really looking forward to participating in the debates because I think that the candidates otherwise would have gotten away where they will get away without having to be specific. And now the question is there anything that we can do as citizens to force the candidates to take responsibility for their records and or be specific about what they would do differently over the next 4 years?
I know. It does seem as though, I mean, first of all, it's a system that wants more voters but not more candidates. We can see that now. And then, I mean, it really is going to be an election in which I feel like I'm going to wake up every day and Sonny and Cher are going to be singing I Got You, Babe, and I'm going to go through the whole thing that I went through 4 years ago, because this election is not going to look substantially different in terms of the candidates or probably in terms of what they say from what it did 4 years ago.
That's right. And as you've written so eloquently, this notion that has become sort of the mainstream mantra of American politics, which is I'm not as bad as the other guy, without actually having to go into any details about yourself or even anything specific about the other guy. And, you know, you want to be careful not to be overly melodramatic, but the one thing we know is that that approach will attract fewer and fewer voters, making the likelihood of third-party candidates less and less because more and more people get turned off. In a number of times when I walked up and asked somebody to sign the petition, their response was, I'm not into politics. And you want to say, you pay taxes, you're an American, we're
politics are into you.
Politics are into you. And the great American irony that somehow we feel that it's our responsibility to spread democracy around the world, unless, of course, people vote against our interests, but we want to spread democracy around the world, but we don't really want too much democracy here at home.
That's a gloomy but I think appropriate place to end. Jonathan Pelter, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right. And we'll be back. Please make a selection in any direction, not just a projection, but vote to get someone good into office, vote to get suckers out of office, vote for any reason at all.
And just in case I missed anybody, I'd like to thank everybody in this, which is the 860 White Pages for 2013. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Jackie Filson. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jack Klugman. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff passed out at Carrot Top's after party, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the hidden world of competitive mini golf. And now, back to Colin.
All right. Tonight are the Emmys, which is unusual in and of itself. They're usually on Sunday nights. A change has been made. So here to talk to us about that and about the probable winners and perhaps the people more deserving of wins. Matthew Gilbert is the TV critic for the Boston Globe and the author of the new book, Off the Leash, A Year at the Dog Park. He and Boston Globe colleague Sarah Rodman do a weekly show about TV called We Love to Watch. So let's start, Matthew Gilbert, with the fact that it's moved to Monday night, which I'm assuming has at least something to do with the fact that so many of the nominated shows, so many of the watchable, talkable kinds of shows appear on Sunday night. So it's feels kind of weird to be watching the new episode of Masters of Sex while, in fact, Masters of Sex is up for some kind of award.
No, Colin.
No.
That would be a lovely idea, but it actually probably has more to do with the MTV Video Music Awards.
Ah.
Yes. You know, all the young people like to watch that.
The fun awards.
Yeah, the fun awards.
The rowdy awards.
Right. The twerking awards. And I think that in combination with the football schedule kind of put NBC in a bit of a corner, and they decided to go with a Monday night.
Well, the other thing that they appear to be interested in, based on a little bit of the reading that I did, is, you know, I mean, some of these award shows, maybe they start to feel a little bit stale. The Emmys always feels like, you know, in some ways the least exciting one, because people who are on television, they can't do things the way Tony award winners can or award nominees can. And
right.
It's a little less of the glamour. But also, people love to live tweet stuff. People love television events, right? So
yeah.
NBC is hoping that a lot of people jump on their Twitter feeds and make fun of people at the Emmys tonight.
Absolutely. I mean, that seems to be able to really give an added dimension of life to a show, as we all know from the Sharknado phenomenon.
So let's talk a little bit about nominees here. And so, and you did, I think, a very interesting sort of chart of probable winners, probable losers, deserving winners and losers. One of the things that you are saying, I think, is that Breaking Bad really does deserve this year, because as it brought itself to such an interesting conclusion, it does deserve some of these awards.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there aren't many great dramas that we can say were consistently good throughout their entire run. I mean, I'm a huge Sopranos guy, but there were a few weak seasons or, you know, half seasons in there. Breaking Bad was just a model TV show, and it's hard to imagine voters not acknowledging that this year. They came a little bit late to the show as a best drama. It did not win that award until last year. Prior to that, it, you know, almost every year went to Mad Men. They understood that Bryan Cranston was extraordinary, but they didn't really honor the show enough. So I think this year they're certainly going to try to make up for that, and, you know, in addition to acknowledging how great that last half season was.
I think also Mad Men and Breaking Bad, they share something else, I think, which is a real sense of beginning to end direction. You know, that there's sort of an overarching game plan here where this show is going.
Yeah.
And I sometimes don't feel that about other shows. I share your admiration for the tremendous performance that Lizzie Kaplan has been giving in Masters of Sex.
Yes.
But as I watch that show, I sort of think, well, they're kind of, I think, maybe getting renewed year to year. I wonder if they really, I mean, I don't always feel that show has quite the unerring sense of direction that, say, Breaking Bad does.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, I agree with you. I love a show that feels very planned out from beginning to end. You know, I think that sort of overall arc can really be a great thing, and it's something that Lost, I think, got lost with. Masters of Sex is kind of based on history, so I think it would be harder for them to really go into the whole show with, you know, a sort of preformed arc, or maybe a little more challenging. But who knows? They may have a long view in mind that we're just not quite aware of yet.
You know, there do seem to be this year some shows that I'm surprised haven't merited a little bit more consideration. And once again, in your writing, you've made it clear. I mean, the Emmy nominating committee seems not to know that there's a show called The Americans that people are getting very excited about, and which seems to be doing some really interesting things with historical fiction and with character development, all kinds of stuff. And it's invisible here in these awards.
It's exactly. I mean, it's just, the Emmys have a history of, you know, ignoring some of TV's best. I mean, it's just so sad. They pretty much ignored The Wire, which has gone on to become one of the top, you know, five ever TV dramas. I think they're making the same mistake with The Americans. I mean, sometimes it has to do with just how much good stuff there is out there. I mean, aside from Downton Abbey, none of the drama series nominees are weak.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, there's not a lot of room. And unfortunately, the Americans just kind of got lost. I feel that way about Vikings as well. I don't know if you've ever seen that show. It's on history, and it's extraordinary. It's a really well-done drama about the Vikings with some amazing performances, and it really has been completely overlooked by Emmys. It's really a shame.
I would also say that about, I haven't seen the Vikings, though I do know people who admire it. Another one that you've mentioned, Damian Bashir on The Bridge, is maybe giving really one of the truly haunting performances on television. And just while we have time, too, if there's one total scenery-chewing performance that anybody's giving on television right now, it's this young Canadian actress, Tatiana Maslany, who's on Orphan Black. I mean, how you could have television acting awards? This woman plays like 9 different characters and sometimes plays 2 different characters talking to one another and reacting to one another. I don't even know how some of the things that she does are even possible.
Yeah. I agree. It's a miraculous performance, and it's hard to understand how the Emmys could ignore it, but they do have a history of snobbery toward genre series. I mean, Game of Thrones has kind of emerged out of that, but they never nominated Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Battlestar Galactica. Sci-fi, fantasy, anything like that, they really tend to kind of snub. It's really too bad and limited.
Matthew Gilbert, we've got about 30 seconds left. You want to make one prediction where tomorrow everybody will say, wow, Matthew Gilbert really nailed that one.
Oh, God. You know, well, I hope John Voight wins. That's all I'll say. I mean, I know Breaking Bad is going to take a lot of the drama categories, but I really hope John Voight wins.
John Voight on Ray Donovan is giving the performance of his career, and it's a performance that doesn't really resemble anybody else's performance, too. It's
exactly.
Really amazing.
Well,
Matthew Gilbert, thank you so much for joining us. Now that we've discovered you, we'll turn to you again in the future. Thanks for being with us today.
I'd love to come back.
All right. Bye-bye now. And we're going to say goodbye, too. Tomorrow we're talking about competitive mini golf. Not you trying to get through the windmill. We're talking about there actually is a tour. There's a national tour that people play on. It has its own stars. And anyway, that'll be tomorrow. Thanks to Kyone Wolf and Betsy Kaplan and Katie Tularski for pulling together today's show.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and I'd like to extend my deepest sympathies to Jon Hamm for not winning tonight at the Emmys. Too soon?